This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Tana Weingartner, filling in for Lucy May. Coming up in the second half of the hour, we'll be talking about composting. First, male contraception. Aside from condoms or a vasectomy, all other forms of birth control fall to women. New research, however, is finding success in male hormonal birth control with a gel, and it's getting close to getting FDA approval. Here to talk about it are Dr. Jeffrey Krupnik, medical monitor with the Contraceptive Development Program at the Eunice Kennedy Shriver National Institute of Child Health and Human Development in Bethesda, Maryland. Welcome, Dr. Krupnik.
Thank you.
And Dr. Scott Lundy, a urologist specializing in men's infertility and sexual medicine at the Cleveland Clinic. Welcome, Dr. Lundy.
Thanks for having me.
You're invited to be part of this conversation as well. You can call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. All right, the National Institutes of Health and something called the Population Council are helping fund development of a gel that suppresses sperm production. And just last month, they released a report saying 86% of participants in clinical studies achieved effective contraception levels within 15 weeks and typically within 8 weeks. So, Dr. Krupnik, let's start with you. Can you just explain what is this gel?
Sure. So the gel consists of two different components. One is nesterone, which is a potent progestin, and the other component is testosterone. And so the way that the gel works is that the progestin, nesterone, helps to stop the signals that originate from the brain, from the hypothalamus and pituitary gland, which ultimately tell the testicle to make high levels of testosterone in support of sperm production. And so when the nesterone blocks that pathway, the testosterone levels in the testicles go very low, and so then sperm production is stopped.
Okay.
However, that being said, the blood levels of testosterone also go low, and that is something that we would like to counteract by providing testosterone in the gel. And so testosterone in the blood is important for sexual function, libido, and so we don't want men to experience the side effects of low testosterone in the blood, which is why we give back testosterone through the gel in order to support normal androgen function.
Okay. And we'll get into some of those other side effects later. And I want to hear about the clinical study in just a moment. But first, like the first question that came to my mind about this study is, how do you use the gel? Like, where do you put it?
Yeah, good question. So the gel is used on a daily basis. And so participants in our trial are given pumps, and the pumps, each pump emits about 2.5 milliliters of the gel. And so participants are instructed to apply 5 milliliters or 2 pumps worth of the gel. And they do so to their upper arm and shoulder. And it just takes not very much time at all for the gel to then be absorbed. And participants are given instructions on how to prevent transfer of the gel to, for instance, their female partners. And they're also given measures to ensure that the gel is absorbed and doesn't, you know, reach anyone who doesn't want to be exposed. And so it's applied daily to the upper arms and shoulders.
Okay. All right. Let's talk about the clinical study. Tell us how it works.
Sure. So in this study, it's a phase 2 study. So we're looking at the safety of the gel, the tolerability of the gel, the efficacy of the gel, and couples. So both a male and their female partner are both enrolled in the study. So both have to give their consent to join the study. And once that's done, and if they're considered eligible, the male partner is given the gel and he applies it every day, like I mentioned, until he achieves adequate suppression of his sperm. And what's generally accepted to be considered an adequate level of sperm suppression is less than or equal to 1 million per mil of sperm in an ejaculate. And so once those levels are achieved, the couple then uses the gel as their sole method of contraception for an entire year. And so if the female partner was using another form of birth control, such as a pill or an IUD, they would have to stop that method so that we could assess the efficacy of the gel over the course of an entire year. Once that year is completed, the male partner stops using the gel, and then we monitor his hormone levels and his sperm concentrations until they return to normal.
And I briefly set up at the top what the finding was, but can you recapsulate that for us, explain the findings of the study?
Oh, sure. So the findings that we presented last month at the annual Endocrine Society conference indicated that the time to suppression, so the time to achieve sperm levels that was at least 1 million per mil or lower, was faster with a median of about a little less than 8 weeks when we compared to other injectable methods that have been investigated previously for male contraception. And that could be injections of testosterone undecanoate or injections of testosterone undecanoate in conjunction with another progestin. In those studies, the median time to reach that threshold of sperm suppression was somewhere between 12 and 15 weeks, whereas in our study it was a little less than 8 weeks. So it was indicative that the gel seems to work faster.
Wow. Okay. Dr. Lundy, what's the history of male birth control, beyond just condoms?
Yeah, so I think it's first important to state that this is really important work that Dr. Krupnik and the team is doing, because we as a society have often thought of contraception as a one-sided street, and it really isn't. It takes two to tango, as we say, and it's important for men to begin to own their reproductive health and reproductive rights within their relationship. And so adding opportunities for men to provide contraceptive options for these couples is really important. Now, we've tried a number of different things over the years to achieve male contraception, and many of them are hormonal based, like the trial that's being discussed today. There are also obstructive based techniques where we put gels into the vas deferens, for example, to try and block the sperm from being able to be passed into the ejaculate. Perhaps the best known blockage technique that we have is a vasectomy, which is a tried and true, designed to be permanent contraception for men who desire no further children. And so a lot of this is identifying a tool that can be used in conjunction with the procedures like a vasectomy in order really just to offer more options and to provide the best treatment that we can for all couples.
Has there been any research into whether men want this or will use a hormonal birth control?
I think that's a really good question, and it speaks again to our societal expectations of women are on oral contraception or have an IUD placed, and there's a societal acceptance to that. I think one of the challenges with any treatment options that we generate within reproductive urology and for men in particular is the societal stigma or the societal acceptance of it, and encouraging men to both become engaged, but then also to be compliant, because if they don't use this or other products as they're intended, and as society has encouraged women to use their OCPs, then we can't guarantee their efficacy to the degree that we would see in studies like this. And so I think it's really important to do the hard science of understanding that products like this work. But then also importantly, we have to begin to change the culture to discuss male reproduction, male infertility, male contraception, normalize that discussion, and empower men to be in charge of their reproductive ability.
Yeah, that, I mean, that's an interesting take, right? Like, whose responsibility is birth control? I mean, it's like you were saying, it's typically seen as women's. How does sexism play into, maybe the slower development of men's birth control?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. And whether it's a scientifically more difficult problem because of the testosterone, I'll defer to my colleague here, but it could be. We also have this expectation that it falls to the woman. And I think that that's a real disservice to couples around the world, where, as we know, both parties should be engaged. And this has come to the forefront recently with the decision to reverse Roe v. Wade, and with the knowledge that we've seen vasectomy numbers climb dramatically, in fact, almost double since that decision, the Dobbs decision, was handed down. And so there is an engagement that happens on the male side. And we as clinicians, I think, should begin to support that and encourage that discussion. Now, what that looks like long term, I think it's too early to say, but I think, you know, we're on the path to beginning to hopefully do better with that.
Just a reminder, this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Yes, Dr. Krupnik, please chime in.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a quick point, and I think what Dr. Lundy may have been alluding to is that one challenge with male contraception is the sperm life cycle, which is approximately 70 days, so a little bit more than 2 months. And so I think that creates a unique challenge to inhibit sperm production, whereas in, with the menstrual cycle, it happens every month. And so that's been one of the challenges with male contraception is just frankly the biology of the sperm, mm-hmm. of the sperm life cycle.
Going back to, you mentioned the reversal of Roe versus Wade, what kind of other factors are influencing this focus for more options for birth control for men?
Yeah, I want to be clear that a lot of this work has been going on for many years. And the trial in particular that we're discussing and its precursor trials predate that that societal change by many, many years. And in fact, many of these hormonal methods have been first described 20 years ago. And we're now only now understanding how they work best and how to best utilize them. But I do think that we are in a renaissance period where reproduction is changing and where we need to be mindful of the intersection between male biology, female biology, policy, and medicine, all in the context of society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do we have this expectation maybe or something that men maybe don't want to use birth control? But especially with younger generations of men, are the clinical trials actually showing that there are many men who are very eager to have this option? Either of you?
I perform vasectomies on young men all the time who have made a conscious decision not to have children, and they may be childless even in their early 20s. And if they're able to understand the risks and the benefits of the treatment that we can offer, then I think we as clinicians should respect that autonomy. And so, yes, I think it's probably growing, but I think in general, we as clinicians also need to be more in tune with what our patients need or want.
Did you want to chime in as well?
I was just going to say that I think anecdotally, at least for the couples that are enrolled in this trial, that, many of the female participants have, maybe once they've entered into the recovery phase and they would have to consider going back on the previous method of birth control prior to enrolling in the study, that some of the female participants have been a little reluctant to return to their previous method of contraception, whether it be due to side effects or just other reasons. And so they've, I think looking at from the female participants' perspective, they've really, really welcome this product, at least during their participation in the trial, especially given it maybe puts a little bit less pressure on them to continue their current method of birth control, especially for whatever reason they don't like it.
All right, we're going to take a really quick break. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Tana Weingartner, filling in for Lucy May. Today we're talking about a male hormonal birth control product that's been found to be pretty effective in clinical trials. Our guests are Dr. Scott Lundy, a urologist specializing in men's health at the Cleveland Clinic, and Dr. Jeffrey Krupnik, medical monitor with the Contraceptive Development Program at the National Institutes of Health. If you have a question about this latest study, you can give us a call at 513-419-7100 or email it to talk@wvxu.org. I want to go back to, I think it was Dr. Lundy who was talking about seeing younger patients that were interested in vasectomies. Is there discussion about young men using this new hormonal type, like boys in high school? Like, are their parents interested in this?
I don't have an answer to that. I think the timing of reproduction varies from person to person. And there are 19-year-olds who desperately want a child, and there are 50-year-olds who never wanted children. And so it really is an individualized decision. And whether a vasectomy is the only tool we have in our toolbox is it shouldn't be. There should be other options, and there should be non-invasive options, and there should be permanent options. And I think having more tools in that toolbox is important.
What about you? Is it a thought that it could help play into reducing, you know, teen pregnancy rates? Either of you?
I mean, in our trial, subjects had to be at least 18 years of age, and so, you know, I think it, you know, just taking that into account that, you know, that was the age cutoff, or at least the minimum mm-hmm. age to enroll. So I guess it remains to be seen, but
I'd be a little worried about the possibility of providing exogenous testosterone to young men who are still in the reproductive development phase, because we do know that testosterone, when used medically for some patients who need it at that age, can cause problems as far as future sperm production. So from a overall reproductive health perspective, I think we should likely encourage younger men up until puberty is fully done and completed and testicle development is done to avoid exogenous testosterone at this time.
Okay, but I mean, and maybe this is outside of your area of expertise, but we put young girls on birth control. How is that different?
We do, and I can only speak to the male side, and I can say that when young men, for example, with certain genetic conditions are placed on testosterone, as is in some cases medically appropriate, it is a challenge to restore their fertility and their sperm production and their whether they have intrinsic testosterone production later in life. It's often a challenge to do that, and it requires expensive and difficult medications to deliver. I can't speak so much to how that compares to the female biology and reproduction. I can say that one difference is that sperm is produced, as Dr. Kripnik said, every second. A thousand sperm are produced every heartbeat. And so this is a different, the kinetics of male reproductive cells are very different because females, of course, are born with their eggs, which is in contrast to men.
Mm-hmm. And I would add that it's important, at least, you know, from our perspective, that, you know, especially with this method, that we ensure that it's reversible. And so that if a couple does desire to become pregnant at some point in the future, that remains a strong possibility. And so, you know, part of the research is to determine how quickly, you know, sperm counts and hormones normalize, so that then, you know, couples who desire pregnancy can then try. And so that's an important aspect, and I think also an appealing quality of contraceptive options, so that you know, as compared to vasectomy, which is the intent is for it to be irreversible, that there are options that are reversible should the couple desire pregnancy.
So you're basically saying the gel is reversible. So how long does it last? You know, explain that for me.
Yeah. So we, you know, that's an active area that we're looking at. You know, the trial, again, it's in its final stages of concluding the major aspects of its activities. And so we'll be, you know, looking at that very closely. But, you know, in terms of reversibility, there's been no indication that it's irreversible at all. And that, you know, in order for subjects to end their participation in the study, we ensure that all counts, all sperm counts and all hormones have returned to normal. So that's a very encouraging aspect of this gel.
What about other side effects? What are the side effects that you're seeing?
Yeah, so, you know, the gel has been very well tolerated. We have seen no concerning safety signals. There's been no major safety findings that we have found so far. You know, we'll do a deeper dive into the data once the study concludes. But again, we've seen no major safety concerns at all with this gel, which also, again, has been very encouraging.
And just real briefly here, how do you know, like, if you take a birth control pill, you know you take Op-Hil. How do you know you're getting the right dosage of a gel?
Well, that's why that's a good point. You know, we do a lot of studies prior to this phase two trial to determine the right amount of nesterone and testosterone that should be included in the gel to achieve the intent, which is to suppress sperm, but also give back the testosterone that the male participant needs. And so we've done a lot of studies prior to ensure that the dose is effective.
Okay. And then to either of you, you know, when could we maybe realistically see something like this, see this gel or some of the other things I think that Dr. Lundy, you mentioned, when might we actually see this get to market?
Well, from the perspective of the gel, again, we're in the final stages of this phase two trial. And so then the next area of business is then to design a phase three trial. And a phase three trial is going to be bigger and it's going to be more participants, and it's the pivotal trial that needs to be conducted before we would then submit a package to the FDA for market approval. And so the next more immediate step is to continue discussions with the FDA to determine the regulatory pathway for approval. As far as we know, both from a hormonal or non-hormonal standpoint, this gel is the furthest along in development for male contraception. And so there's really no precedent to follow to determine what it takes and what regulatory requirements need to be met to then achieve market approval. It will likely be years before this type of product would be available to the public. Again, we have to have a well-designed phase three trial, which will require input from the FDA. And then it takes time to complete that trial and then analyze the data and then submit everything that needs to be submitted for the FDA to then consider approval of the gel.
Do you have any timeline when phase three might start?
That's a good question. We're hoping soon. It's a little hard to predict, but hopefully soon, perhaps next year. Again, that really will hinge on further discussions with the FDA and the design of the phase three that seems appropriate, so that that once that trial is completed, then we can submit what's needed for the FDA to determine if the product is approved for market.
Okay. And I know you said several years, but I want to try and pin that down a little bit. I feel like I read in some of the research for this 4 years. Did I just pull that number out of a hat? Is that?
Yeah, it's hard to tell. Honestly, I can probably just say it will take years. It's hard to know, trials, it's hard to predict exactly how long they'll take. It hinges on a lot of things such as recruitment, enrollment, and how many participants need to be enrolled. And so it's hard to tell. Honestly, the best estimate I could give is it will be years.
Okay. We've got about a minute and a half left. I'd like just to hear both of your sort of closing thoughts on this, how you see it affecting your industry and men's health in general. Why don't we turn to you first, Dr. Lundy, please?
Yeah, I think further research in male reproduction is really important, and this is an important stepping stone in that. I think a blessing and a curse is that our existing option of a vasectomy has a lot of well-proven safety and efficacy, and they are indeed intended to be permanent, but they can be reversible. And so what we need to do is provide safe and reliable options to patients and adequate data on how efficacious they are in the real world. And then from there, patients can make their own decisions. And if perhaps the efficacy of these treatments is slightly different, but the risk or the benefits are different, then that's a decision a patient can make.
And Dr. Krupnik?
Yeah, I think it's just important to have options. There's quite a few options on the female side and not many on the male side. And so I think that when you have more options, then patients can then determine what is the best option for them, weighing the risks and the benefits, and then really determine what avenue they'd like to proceed with. And so I think having options is just really important, kind of echoing what Dr. Lundy just stated.
Well, thank you so very much, both of you, for this interesting conversation. Dr. Scott Lundy is with the Cleveland Clinic. Thank you, Dr. Lundy.
And yeah, absolutely.
And Dr. Jeffrey Krupnik from the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development, thank you as well.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Coming up next, we're talking all things composting. What is it, how it works, and how you can compost at home, even if you don't have a yard. Stay tuned. This is Cincinnati Edition.